Good afternoon. We will call the Senate Public Safety Budget Division Committee meeting to order. As you can see, I am not Senator Higgins. She is across the hall at another meeting right now, so I will carry the meeting until she gets back. I want to welcome all of you to the committee hearing. The first item on the agenda is to give us some information on the effects of local government aid cuts to local law enforcement and fire services. Some members of the committee have expressed a particular interest in hearing directly from the local government representatives about this impact. So we will be able to ascertain that today. We appreciate your coming here. We've got a lot of people to share information with us today, and so we'd like to ask the witnesses to try to limit your comments to about 5 minutes per person, and we'll deal with questions and so on as they arise. But why don't we go ahead? We've got Scott Nadeau, Police Chief from Columbia Heights, and Gary Gorman, Fire Chief from Columbia Heights. Welcome.
Thank you.
Why don't you go
ahead.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you.
First of all, we'd just like the opportunity to thank everyone gathered for receiving this information. Obviously, this is a subject near and dear to the hearts of public safety and the residents in Columbia Heights. Just as a,
why don't you start off by identifying yourself for the record? The tape doesn't know your voice.
So. Sure. I'm Scott Nadeau, and I am the police chief in the city of Columbia Heights.
I'm Gary Gorman. I'm the fire chief for the city of Columbia Heights.
Go ahead, chief.
Just as a brief overview of what the city is facing in Columbia Heights, we were unallotted about $338,000 in 2008, the last part thereof. About $460,000 we were reduced in 2009, and about $960,000 is projected for 2010. As a result of that, that ends up being for 2009 about 10% of the city's budget. And the impacts have been felt both in public safety and citywide. Citywide in the city of Columbia Heights, each employee is taking an 80-hour unpaid furlough. There was a couple of ways that that was accomplished, but one of the impacts, obviously, on the police department was that we were not able to hire a vacant position, which was a 27th officer. And then the impact of this unpaid furlough was over one FTE. So in a smaller agency that operates on very limited lines for things like overtime, training, and overtime to be utilized in a proactive capacity to be out working on problems in the city, we have already lost a couple of positions in addition to our crime prevention specialist, whose job it was to work within the context for a strategic plan to go out and work on prevention strategies within the community. There's been additional impacts in laying off of full-time community service officers. These are employees that go out and perform a lot of the tasks that need to be performed in a police department that don't require a sworn officer. The impact of that in the city of Columbia Heights has been that we now have sworn officers that are doing a lot of these tasks that we would have wanted to delegate to people at a lower pay grade. It's unknown, obviously, exactly what the impacts of 2010 will be. But to this point, I think that as far as the police department is concerned and city operations in general, they've tried to keep the number of permanent layoffs kind of at bay. And I think that this time citywide, we've had about five or six permanent layoffs. But with the furloughs and some other things, we're only going to be able to stretch that so far. And so the concern on our part is that we've seen a crime decrease in the last year of over 20% in Part 1 and Part 2 offenses, much of that realized through proactive policing. And, you know, the concern is that some of those advances or gains that we've made will now be reversed because of our ability to work proactively in community policing types of initiatives.
Chief?
A little bit about Columbia Heights. We are a first-ring suburb on the northeast edge of Minneapolis. For a community, we're 3.5 square miles, very small, 18,000 residents, or a little bit more than that. And it doesn't have a lot of huge areas of industrial and large commercial tax base, mostly residential. Because it's a first-ring suburb, obviously we have issues with aging housing stock and high increasingly higher amounts of rental property, and what this is causing is a more of a need based on the turnover from our elderly population into the next generation of residents that are moving in, a higher need for public services, especially on the fire department, on the EMS. We run a rescue squad besides the fire department, and our calls have continually increased every year for over the last 10 years. 2,500 emergency medical and fire calls in a town 3.5 square miles is extremely high. We should not have that kind of a call base. And most 90% of that is our EMS calls. And with all these cuts in the hospitals and the ambulance services also, the increase in the amount of response time for medicals is also going up, unless you have a community like ours that many years ago made the choice to have a handful of full-time firefighters on duty so that they could take care of the EMS side. Obviously, in both services, you can have all the nice fire trucks and all the fancy equipment and high-tech computers and all these things, but the bottom line is people are the ones that end up doing the work. It's the people that drive the fire trucks, people that put out the fires, people that actually provide the care for your residents. And when 90% of your budget is people, there's not a lot else you can cut. Over the last few years, we have cut, going back to the 2003-2004 LGA cuts, when we lost 15% those years. We got a little bit back in 2006 and 2007, but now the city has, obviously with these cuts, there are extreme cuts to our city. And what pretty much is left after these furloughs is people. There's only so much equipment you can cut. Most cities are putting off replacing equipment, whether it's the turnout gear the firefighters are wearing or you know, the air packs that they wear, or safety equipment or EMS equipment. You're putting off replacement for longer periods of time, which does put your firefighters into more of a in a little bit more danger that the equipment they have isn't up to modern standards and meet modern codes. But you don't have a lot of choice, because obviously we want to protect our people, because as much as possible, their jobs, because again, that's who does the work for you, not all the fancy equipment, it's the people. So I know in Columbia Heights, you know, this year with the cuts, we lost clerical, but with the furloughs and the vacation buybacks, we're going to have a lot of shifts that have to be covered with people gone, and that will also slow down our response because of that, because we have a minimum of two people going out in a truck, so until you get two people to go, you can't leave the station, and that can cut your response times. It's going to increase them quite a bit on those days. Next year, with the $960,000 cut, it would be, we believe we're probably going to end up losing firefighters, probably the full-time firefighter or two. We do have a small staff of paid on call. But again, because of the size of our city and the age and the type of residents that are moving into our city, we have a hard time getting anybody to want to be paid on call firefighters or volunteers, as sometimes they're called. The amount of time to go into meeting state certification standards and the EMS training and the constant the OSHA standards and all this extra training that you have to constantly do to keep up to a certain level to provide to do the jobs, a lot of people don't want to have that kind of time away from their families. It's an extreme amount of time. 2 years to get somebody from walking in a door to get them where they can be a full-time or a paid-on-call firefighter with all their training. It's a 2 years of training. And it's a lot of time away from families and friends and activities. So that side of it is becoming very difficult in order just to get anybody to be volunteer firefighters or paid-on-call firefighters in today's world.
Chief, do you know, or either of you know, about what proportion of the city's budget is covered by the police and fire departments?
The fire is about 12%.
I think that public safety combined is about 50%. You know, it depends on if you factor out debt service and some other things, but operationally it's about half.
And, you know, there's been some talk about trying to keep cuts away from, you know, the public safety budget when cuts are made to local government aid. How have you seen that play out in your own city's dynamics?
I think that from my point of view, I think the city has done its best to try and insulate public safety from some of those cuts. But when we're such a significant portion of the budget, you know, I think it's hard to look at, you know, millions of dollars of cuts and not, you know, look at public safety to some extent. I mean, you still need to plow the streets. You still need to do a lot of the things that the city has to do operationally. And so, you know, I think it's going to be difficult. Whether we're cut to the same level that some other city departments are cut, I think that will be the true question. It won't be whether or not public safety is going to be cut. The only other thing I wanted to bring up, and I know that we're probably running up against our 10 minutes here, is in reviewing some of these cities that really are hard hit by LGA, I just wanted to make the point that I came from Brooklyn Center about 10 months ago to take the Chiefs job in Columbia Heights. It's another city that's impacted quite a bit. These are some of the communities that are dealing with a lot of cultural issues, a lot of immigrant populations, a lot of areas where it would really require the police to be reaching out to be connecting with some of the people in our community, as opposed to being kind of reduced back to just being responsive call takers. And certainly there's other cities that can speak to that need, but the cities that are more dependent on LGA to be able to do some of the things that it's done, whether it's connecting with youth mentoring, you know, a lot of the programs that we have in our schools right now, whether it's liaison officers or trying to connect with other community partners and things like after-school activities, these are the types of programs that typically would go away first, not because we would want them to, but because our core mission really is to provide policing services. And that's just another thing that you may want to consider.
One other thing is which Columbia Heights had a little trouble with this last time around is, in most cities, they had union contracts that were settled for 2008, 2009, 2010. And I know for 2009, city employees got 3% pay increase. The levy limits that were put on for 2009 didn't even cover, we weren't able to even cover the 3% pay increase for the city employees without taking money out of reserves to cover that. So the city had, they basically had their hands tied if it came to wanting to raise taxes in the community to make coverages for cuts on any of our departments with the 3.9% levy limits. Because it just, I realize that those are in place still for 2010 and I believe 2011, which that also hurts us quite a bit, even if we wanted to try to raise taxes in our community. Even our community tax base isn't that great for raising taxes. That really also kind of handcuffs us a little bit to try to make it up. So in one sense, you're really being forced to cut, and public service is going to be one of the things cut.
Right. Well, thank you. Any questions from members of the committee? Chief Nadeau, Chief Gorman, thank you for coming by. We really appreciate you taking the time to come here today. It's very helpful.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
We'd now like to welcome Eric Sorensen, City Manager from Winona, and Frank Pomeroy, Police Chief from Winona. And I see Senator Erickson Ropes has come in. If you'd like to join the Winona folks at the witness table, you're welcome to do so, Senator.
Sure, and we should have you in the middle.
And if you would please identify yourself for the record when you speak, we'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you for allowing us to give testimony. My name is Eric Sorensen. I am the city manager in Winona. And I think my role is to lay the framework for what the chiefs will say. When I came to Winona in 1987, we had 200 full-time equivalent employees. With the budget this year, my projection right now is we will be at 180. I think we have done our job over the years. I think we've been good stewards of the money that the state has given us. I don't think we've been frivolous. And we are a one of 17 micropolitan statistical areas in Minnesota. We are a regional center. As such, Winona supplies 84% of the county employment. That's over 20,000 jobs. And 83% of the county's retail sales. That impacts everybody. And the previous testimony went to the point, which is certainly our point, and that is when you're talking public safety, it's everything. As Chief Pomeroy will say, he couldn't do it on his own. We were back in the early 90s trying to work with everybody in the community. So if we take away children's summer programming, we close down the library, we do all those things that people don't call public safety, all that's going to do is increase the burden on police and fire. We have over 80, I think it's about 8,500 students now at Winona State, 2,000 at St. Mary's. We have a technical college. Those institutions we certainly love. We're not here saying we want you to take those institutions away, although we might trade you for the University of Minnesota and its impact. Our job is to take care of the people in our community. And so when we got our notice of cuts in December, which was $640,000, with about 2 weeks to go, we paid our bills. That took our budget down at that time, our cash by $640,000. I went to the council in January. I made the same recommendation that we cut another $640,000. We're not here to tell you that we don't deserve to be part of the solution. We just want to be treated fairly. So we are anticipating that the lower bar that the governor set in 2008 will be there in 2009. Two examples, and the chiefs will spend just a little bit of time on this too. Again, to make the point about public safety, some of you may remember the flood of 2 years ago. We were the regional center that did actually, I think, a lot more work outside of our corporate limits, helping people, helping our neighbors to some distance, in fact. Then we had the ferry service and the bridge, whether it's coming down or not, this last year. Again, our role was to provide where we could help to keep our economy going, frankly. And we succeeded, and people were able to have a fun ride across the river to get to and from their jobs. And that is our role. Public safety, again, bottom line, is every service that we provide.
Thank you. I forgot to note in the introductions that Fire Chief Edward Krall is also here. Whatever order you'd like to go in. Senator Ingebrigtsen, you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. A question, Mr. Sorensen, with regards to your cash in hand and cash on reserves,
mm-hmm.
Can you give me a little idea when times are good, what kind of cash you have on reserves so I have an idea, and what is this going to bring you down to now?
We really don't keep anything on reserve other than we try and keep our cash flow available. So our LGA allocation is approximately $10 million. So we're always looking at when the payment comes in from the state, which is twice a year, and making sure that we do not have inadequate funds, in other words, have to borrow short term like school districts do, and start down that cycle of paying interest. So at any given moment in time, I'm not exactly sure what our finance department, I have a great finance director, has on hand, but it's based upon the two checks that come in from the state approximately twice a year.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on that, then you talked about cutting down from 200 to 180 employees now, and you also talked about having the university within the city limits. Can you give me a little sense, or maybe that's a question for the chief, as to you'd have the university police on campus there, and you don't have that?
No. We have security.
All right.
We don't have sworn police officers.
Maybe I can, Senator Foley. About 3 years ago, one of my deputy chiefs retired and took over as a security director at Winona State University. And he was able over the last 2 years to convince them that they needed some retired full-time police officers to take a role in security at Winona State. So now they believe they have a director, and they have two retired police officers, one deputy sheriff and former DNR agent that are now working with Winona State as former law enforcement officers, along with a lot of students.
We're not reimbursed for our service.
None.
Thank you.
With that, if you don't mind, I will take over. Frank Pomeroy.
Go ahead, Chief Pomeroy.
That's correct. Frank Pomeroy, City of Winona Police Chief. City Manager Eric Sorensen certainly talked to the issue of what typically happens in tough economic times. I've been the chief in Winona for 22 and a half years, so I went through the recessions of the 80s when our department lost over four people. And I can tell you that the result of that was a dramatic increase in criminal activity. Due to the Clinton grants and some other things that came about, we were able to put back into place the number of officers that we've had historically in the city of Winona. And over the last 10 years, with a lot of the proactive things that we now have done in policing, community liaison officer, crime prevention, strong narcotics program, working with Project Fine and bringing immigrant populations into our community. A lot of these different kinds of programs which have partnered us with the community, we have dropped our crime rate by almost 55 to 60%. We've dropped our felonies by almost 60%. Now that is a tribute to the partnerships and the cooperation, corroborative efforts that we have been able to help foster and enable within our community because we have had the people to do that. I will be leaving the end of March and retiring, and I know that the position will be replaced, but the person will not. I have two more officers who are leaving this year, one in July and one in December. There is a good chance, if LGA is cut, that both of those positions will not be replaced. So we will go back into the same position we were in the 80s when a recession hit and the crime will spike, and we'll have all kinds of problems. One of the main problems that we have in Winona, literally, is that we're on the I-90 corridor. And we have an influx of gangster disciples from Chicago who dropped their crack cocaine and now crystal methamphetamine in our community. We have gone from investigating between 45 and 50 drug-related crimes a year to over 135 a year. The Southeast Minnesota Narcotics Task Force is one of the most active in the state of Minnesota, and a lot of it has to do with the I-90 corridor and the people that drop their poison in our communities. I had to increase my narcotics officers to two, from one to two, 2 years ago, just to try to keep up with the number of gangbangers and drug dealers that were coming into our community. And they work hard, and they work a lot, and they keep up the best that they can. But we can't afford to lose that battle. Because if we lose that battle, we lose a lot. We lose a significant portion of our community. 2 years ago, we suffered a horrible homicide where a drug dealer from Milwaukee moved into our community, murdered a young lady, murdered her child, and the woman who was carrying his baby. It's horrific in a community of our size to see those kinds of things happen. One of the other things I would like to touch on briefly, and then I'll turn it over to Chief Kroll, is that Eric mentioned, or City Manager Sorensen mentioned, the floods of 2007. We are 100 miles away from the metropolitan of Minneapolis-St. Paul. We're 50 miles away from Rochester. When those floods hit us, they hit in an area where there had never been water before. There were 6 feet of water moving 80 miles an hour with propane tanks being carried along. And we literally got out there and brought a lot of people in who had boats, who were just common citizens who showed up because something was going on. We got them out on the water, even in dangerous circumstances. And in Minnesota City Goodview and the Sailor and Gunderson edition, we helped rescue over 250 people whose lives were in jeopardy. One person was injured. We could not have done that if we did not have the number of first responders and active first responding officers that we have available to us. In the city of Winona, and Senator Rolfes will know this, Rushford lost all of their police vehicles. They just were washed away. We literally took one of our police officers and one of our squads and patrolled the streets of Rushford for over a month and a half when they tried to repair the damage that was done by that flood. We also did the same thing in Goodview and Minnesota City that are just to our south, just to our north. We had to provide their police services and did that without a question because it needed to be done. So what I say to you is that in police, in public safety, over 90% of our budget is personnel, and when cuts come to our departments, it's personnel. So I hope you think about that as you take a look at LGA and how important it is to our communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Chief Kroll?
Ed Kroll, Fire Chief, City of Winona. Just to following up on Chief Pomeroy and the other fire chiefs and public officials that were up here, we faced those same issues. The last unallotment cost us a position that we could not fill because of this allotment. This position was on our suppression force, so I took our fire prevention officer and put him on our suppression force. I'm a strong believer in fire prevention. If a fire department, if a public fire protection agency is going to solve a problem, they have to be proactive, and that's done through fire prevention and public education. Feeling as strong and as important as that is, why would I put somebody into the suppression mode? Because you still need certain number of people to respond to a fire immediately if you're going to maintain that fire to its room of origin. You have to have an X number of people there in the fastest time possible. So it's a balancing act, but it set us back, in my mind, about 20 years as a fire department. 20 years ago, our fire department was studied, and the business community came forward and said, as our suppression forces are reduced, we have to increase our prevention forces to maintain a certain level of protection in our community. Well, now we're back where we were over 20 years ago. We lost that capability through this last unallotment. Also, that unallotment, our clerical support had to go from full-time to half-time. Right in the middle of this unallotment, we were in the process of hiring more of our part-time or volunteer people. We anticipated hiring about 15 to 16 people. We had to cut that back to 7 people because the money just wasn't there. So it just keeps trickling down and down and down. Our overtime budget was greatly reduced to help cover this unallotment. How does that affect us without that overtime? Without that overtime, I cannot send personnel to schools outside the cities. Without that training, you're not going to keep up your skills. It's been said time and time again. Training is the best investment any organization can make in itself, whether it be government or private industry. I can see our training taking a downward turn drastically. So those were the effects of the last unallotment, and I'm really apprehensive what will happen this summer if the city's anticipated check is not what it was scheduled to be if there's another unallotment.
Let's talk about the tanks.
During the flood that was alluded to in 07, the Winona Fire Department responded quite a ways outside of its jurisdiction into areas where there was no mutual aid. I mean, we had no legal obligation to go there, but we certainly felt an ethical and moral obligation. One of these areas contained what we call a tank farm of LP tanks. These tanks were all floating in water that was swift water. They were tanks were breaking off valves. We had LP tanks leaking. During this flood, we had underground natural gas leaking, bubbling up through the water. Plus, we had down power lines arcing. I called the state of Minnesota duty officer asking for the what we call a CAT team, hazardous material, out of Rochester, approximately 40 miles away from us. Hey, we need help. We can't handle this. As I'm in our EOC, our Emergency Operations Center, I get a call from the state, from Minnesota Pollution Control, telling me that I should put this out on contract and on sealed bids. I'm not going to tell you what I repeated to that person as the receiver went back down. We handled it ourselves. We had to. We had no choice. We got no help from the state. Eventually, the word did get through to the state team, and they would have come. But we said, no, that's too late now. It was an hour or two later. The emergency was passed. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Sorensen, I'm sorry, I didn't hear this. How long have you been the city manager for Winona?
Going on 22 years.
So, Mr. Chair, Mrs. Sorensen, you were there in 2003 when
we lost $1.5 million.
Right. So could you share with us kind of the reductions and reductions and reduction, where you were at in 2003 and where you are at today, 2003 to 2005 to, you know, just successively to this year?
We ride the wave. And, you know, we're totally contingent. We're like the state. We have to have a balanced budget. The charter that I work under says I have to submit a balanced budget. So in 2003, we closed the library to some degree. We cut services in police and fire. I think equipment was an issue in 2003.
And Mr. Sorensen, how much was that in 2003 that you lost in LGA?
$1.5 million.
$1.5. And how much do you get total? Were you
$10
million. $10 million, you were getting that in 2000 and in the 2001 budget cycle, right? So when the LGA cuts took place in the 2003 budget year, you lost 1.5?
Right.
And then how much do you sustain in cuts the following cuts?
Well, we started to ramp up again. We aren't back up to where we were at in 2003. And then, of course, we took the cut in December of $640,000. I went back to the council again in January, another $640,000. That's $1.3 million in essentially a month. And just trying to keep the pieces together in such a way that we don't have to lay off people. Again, we've gone from the time I came to 204 full-time equivalents. You all know you need the equivalent in there, or you can play a lot of games with how many employees you have. 204, and we think we'll be down to around 180 as this year unfolds. We're also 50% larger in landmass than we were in 1987 because of an annexation process. So we have a lot more area to cover. We have actually less people. We have modernized everywhere that we can. I'm very proud of our people. They're well-trained, at least today. They're well-trained, and we have good equipment. And it was said before, it's coming down to people. Simple as that.
Mr. Sorensen, could you comment on what proportion of the city's budget is public safety, and what's your perspective on the ability to keep LGA cuts away from those areas?
Public safety, police and fire, is a little over 40%. And we don't have I always have a hard time with the term public safety and public works, because from my perspective, it's so intertwined. Those police, fire, and public works are our major employee centers. And so if we lose more money, we continue to lose more money, have no ability to find new sources, we're going to be laying off people in those areas. The chiefs have just spoken that we'll have vacancies this year. I've tried to as I can, go to where there's a vacancy and not hit a real person. And I've been very proud, in fact, of that fact. And we have in police three positions probably this year. We are not filling one of them for sure. In fire, we might have as many as three positions available.
So levy caps are affecting your ability to
place the loss. It's compounding everything that we provide service for.
Thank you. Senator Erickson Ropes, did you have anything you wanted to add?
No, Mr. Chair. I'll just give an applause here to the gentleman coming up from southeastern Minnesota today. These guys have been at the service of the city for over 20 years, all of them. They're community leaders, and Winona prides itself on being a very frugal community, and I believe every dollar is watched back home. They'll tell you this, and they're good stewards of every single dollar that the state sends them. One of the things that's unique in Winona is that our community really reaches across borders, as you've heard some examples here this morning, but internally within the organizational infrastructure, we work very closely with the colleges and with the local school districts. The city partners with the county as much as possible. So there's lots of collaborations going on. And because of these, we've been able to deal with some tough times. But that's also very smart systems thinking. And Eric and I, or Mr. Sorensen, has had quite a few conversations with me about systems. And if you cut in one area, sometimes you just shift a problem or an expense into another area. And I think it's really key that we keep some of this in mind. You know, cuts in one sector can really fall out and cause balloon out into the public safety sector.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't know who to direct this to, but first of all, I'd like to know, didn't we fund some flood damage and other types of things in the city or the county?
Yes. Eric Sorensen.
Mr. Sorensen?
Yes, you did, and the greater region is certainly appreciative of that. But much of what we have identified that we did from a service standpoint, we didn't get reimbursed for that, and we didn't ask to be reimbursed for that. And we knew that if our neighbors were going to go through some horrific problems, it was going to affect us. So, yes, you did provide money, and we appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Foley.
And Mr. Sorensen, one of the things you talked about was the having State University and St. Mary's and Technical College and so forth. And and I really look at that, I think, as a marvelous places to have in your community, and you certainly wouldn't want to lose them. But I'm wondering if there's some possibility of developing training programs right there in the city of Winona rather than to have to ship employees to other locations. And
That is provided to some degree through the Technical College, and there may be other programs. The chiefs can speak to that. But there are certain kinds of training that there aren't substitutes for in the local setting where we need specialized training, and the chiefs can speak to that.
Senator Foley, some of the cultural diversity type training that I'm talking about is afforded us both through a collaboration between Project Fine and people from Winona State and St. Mary's University. We can do a lot of those kinds of training, but it gets to the nuts and the bolts of police work, which is interrogation, different street crimes classes, different kinds of things that we have to send people to for ERT, SWAT training, other kinds of things. You know, we have to have that 42 hours every 3 years to keep our licenses. And the Post Board does, in fact, give us some monies back to help offset some of those costs to cities, and we appreciate that. But there are certain things we simply do not have available within the city that afford the officers the level of training that they need to stay street ready.
All right. To Senator Foley's point about, yes, we are appreciative of the university, but as I said in my opening comments, and President Romali is a good friend of mine, we'll trade Winona State straight up for the U, because we know what the economic impact would be on our community.
Thank you, all of you, for driving up today. We appreciate your testimony. It's very helpful.
Thank you.
We want to welcome now to the table there Barry Fritz, police chief from Richfield, and Brad Sweam. Correct me if I mispronounce it. I'm sorry. Fire chief from Richfield. Thank you.
Perfect.
Senator Foley, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Brad Spim. I am the fire chief of the city of Richfield. We certainly thank you for giving us some opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you.
Real briefly, the city of Richfield Fire Department answers about 3,500 response time critical events each year, fire medical emergencies, other rescues, also events including environmental. All of our personnel are highly trained, well beyond, not to the paramedic level, but well beyond the EMT level, emergency medical technician with enhancements. And those folks, and about those 3,500 runs, about 80% are emergency medical runs, is very typical. And those folks provide that vital first link in the chain of survival for medical emergencies such as cardiac arrest, strokes, trauma, incidents, such like that. We have 24 career personnel that work the shifts and two chief officers who pick up all the other administrative, fire marshal, but also do respond operationally. With looming budget cuts or LGA on allotments, several positions that probably will be coming open will not be filled or will be delayed in being filled. What this really comes down to is forcing us to make a decision to reduce our daily staffing of firefighters that we have working on the rigs. What that turns into us for us is instead of the normal six firefighters on duty at a time, we are looking at reducing it to five. That takes one of our three emergency response vehicles out of service on a daily basis. We go from three to two. Some of the results of that are going to be, and this is going to be for fire departments in general that are facing this, and I know a lot of detail on some specific has been brought out. It'll result in an average increased response time for both that first arriving unit and for the balance of the needed number of responders at events. Due to multiple or simultaneous events, which we experience quite often with 3,500 runs a year, there could be delays or possibly no emergency medical response prior to the arrival of an ambulance during simultaneous events. Delayed responses will mean that less people will survive events such as cardiac arrest, respiratory arrest, people suffering from strokes or severe trauma. That critical chain of care starts right from the beginning. There are quite a few statistics that show that in those cases, people survive those events such as stroke or trauma, but with more physical and or mental deficits without getting that rapid treatment. For fires such as a house fire, fire crews, with our five-person staffing, oftentimes, versus our six, oftentimes we'll have to wait for mutual aid to arrive from neighboring communities before employing one of the most effective firefighting tactics there is, and that's entering the structure to put the fire out from the inside. The delay in these folks being able to use those tactics, three things arise from that. Certainly, it decreases the chances for rescue or survivability of occupants that may still be in the structure. It's going to allow the fire to grow in intensity. Fire generally will double in size about every minute. This increases the risk of firefighters, and it increases the fire loss. And we have to look at fire loss from about three perspectives. One is the direct dollar loss will rise instead of a one-room fire, possibly the whole structure is involved. Just recently, we have had several structure fires that because of, even with a six-person staffing, and we need our outside neighbors to help us to continue that fight, we've had several $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 losses that easily could have been $100,000 to $250,000 losses. There's also increased loss due to use of being able to use the property. And in the cases of commercial properties, business interruption losses increase, and that can be very compounding and tough economic times. So I've tried to be brief here, but these are some of the immediate effects. Other programs such as fire prevention, training, hazard reduction programs we run, and also code compliance activities will be reduced, and eventually you have long-term effects of those. I think all these really affect the livability of our community greatly. In closing, Richfield has a fairly large elderly population, and by nature, they often experience medical emergencies and do rely on both fire department first response and the advanced life support ambulance services. When economic times get hard, the EMS system, by nature, gets used more, and there's more stresses and strains put on it. And this just compounds staffing reductions. So I do want to thank you for that time today. I certainly can entertain any questions you may have.
Thank you, Chief. I see Senator Kielash has arrived. Senator, if you'd like to join the witnesses at the table, you're certainly welcome to do so. Appreciate your being here. Chief Fritz?
Senator Foley, committee members, thank you for having me here today. My name is Barry Fritz, and I'm the Public Safety Director for the City of Richfield. In that capacity, I also serve as the police chief. You've heard the other testimony from other police chiefs here, and really it's just the same refrain for Richfield that I'm going to be talking to you about. We're a city that's a first-ring suburb for Minneapolis. We have approximately 35,000 people, and we have 45 sworn police officers there. We were unallotted $619,000 for 2008. We will be losing $860,000 for 2009, and it's anticipated that Richfield will lose about $1.8 million in 2010. I know that there are some that have said that they believe that if city managers sharpen their pencils, that they can meet these cuts without reducing public safety services, police and fire in particular, and that's simply not the case. Police and fire in Richfield compromise about 40 to 50% of the budget. That's the same as about other cities. And when the cuts are that great, you simply can't pass those on to the remaining 50% of the city. In 2003, we lost a significant amount of local government aid, and we cut an emergency management coordinator position, a juvenile resource specialist, and a crime-free multi-housing coordinator, in addition to a secretarial position. We also extended the number of years that we had police cars on the road. We cut our training budget and made many other cuts that have made us very lean. Those cuts are still in force today. We never regained those positions back. The problem is that some of those functions were critical to the police department, and we had typically had civilians performing those functions because, for economic reasons, it's less expensive to have a civilian doing those functions or clerical people doing them than sworn police officers. But those duties that were still necessary have now been distributed among other police officers and other remaining staff and other command staff personnel, which is not terribly efficient use of those dollars. Now in 2009, we have to cut another $860,000 from the budget. And being that the police department is a significant amount of the city budget, we have to step up and take some responsibility for those cuts. Our personnel costs are 85% of our budget, just like most of the other cities around here. So if we have to remove a couple $100,000, we can't do it without cutting personnel also. We currently have a CSO vacancy, that's community service officer, that won't be filled. We have one police officer vacancy that will not be filled, and we're anticipating another retirement from a police officer, and that vacancy won't be filled either. That means that a police cadet that we have on our police department that has a culturally diverse background won't be able to be backfilled into that police officer's position. That cadet position was funded by a grant from the Joint Community Police Partnership, and it was intended to add officers to our department that have a diverse background. I think that was a very important program, and unfortunately, that officer is not going to be hired by us. Now, for this year, we're going to be eliminating four other positions. They are civilian positions, but once again, some of them are critical, and we are going to have to backfill those positions or those duties with police personnel, command staff, detectives. And once again, that's going to take their time from doing important police duties. Still, we're going to lose the Neighborhood Crime Watch program, National Night Out, Community Crime Prevention and Education programs, Safety Camp, Citizens Police Academy, and the Crime Alert Network. These are all very valuable proactive programs. Some of them have been in place for over 15 years, and we credit them with the reduction in crimes that we've seen over many years. I think proactive policing and community policing has been a critical part of our strategy, and without those resources, we're going to revert back just to reactive police, and I'm afraid we're going to see a rise in crime. With the economy the way that it is, I'm sure that we're posed for an increase in crime. I've been in police work for 34 years, and I'd love to take credit for the rise or the reduction in crime that has occurred in the past 10 or 15 years. But I think if you look back, it's probably more related to the economy than anything else. There's no question as the economy falters, there's going to be an increase in crime. You're going to have youth that are unemployed and marginalized, and they're going to turn to gangs. You're going to have otherwise law-abiding people that really out of desperation are going to commit crimes to get money for rent, to put clothes on the backs of their kids, and to feed their children. I think you're going to see a rise in alcohol and drug use because as people become disenchanted and unable to cope with their financial situations, they typically may turn to drug and alcohol to ease the pain of those situations. This all is going to be an increased burden on the police department. We're going to have to reduce personnel if we are going to have cuts like that are anticipated, and there's no question that it's going to lead to an increase in response times, our ability to enforce laws, and our ability to investigate crimes. Thank you.
Chief, could you comment on the efforts of the City of Richfield and perspective on keeping cuts away from law enforcement, as has been suggested, can be done despite LGA cuts? And also, could you comment on shared service arrangements and equipment sharing and so on as essentially an urban or first-ring suburban community closely contiguous with other such departments? What kind of efforts have you made in that regard?
Well, we do have an officer that we've placed on the Metropolitan Gang Task Force, which is, I'm sure you're familiar with that that effort. And that is a force multiplier. We don't see that we lose one officer by doing that. We actually gain the strength of that task force. In the past, we've put officers on other task forces, such as the DEA, but frankly, we've pretty much lost those officers. The DEA really isn't too interested in dealing with crimes at lower levels, such as Richfield. On a regular basis, we need to rely on the surrounding communities to assist us on regular call loads during busy times in our city. We rely on mutual aid from Bloomington, Edina, the airport, and the city of Minneapolis on a regular basis. Our staffing levels, our patrol levels, sometimes we have as few as five people on the street. If you understand police procedures, you know that on any call of any significance at all, there have to be two police officers that go there. If one is involved in an arrest situation, that takes him off the street for sometimes 1 or 2 hours. So it's necessary to rely on other cities, and we do that.
What have you observed as the impact of levy caps on the city's budget?
Well, I think we were capped at, well, we could only levy 1.85 for 2009, and of course, we can't change that now. It's all the tax statements have been out, and there's no ability. The levy cap, I think, was 3.9, but we were only allowed to levy up to 1.85 because we were supposed to be getting, I think, $2.6 million in local government aid. But then that was unallotted at the end of the year for 2008 and has been reduced for 2009. So we're basically stuck with a deficit of $860,000 that we can't tax back. We can't levy it back. There's really no means of raising that. I mean, we've looked at the revenue side. The city manager is looking at the revenue side. There are some fees that can be added, but it's certainly not going to make up for the losses. When you're talking about $860,000, that's clearly personnel.
Chief, there's someone else at the table wants to add to that. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes. Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve Devich, and I'm the city manager of the city of Richfield.
Welcome.
I'd like to quickly respond to a question that you asked a second ago, and that is, what have we done to try and keep some of these cuts away from public safety and fire? And let me just say that between public safety and fire together, and with public safety, I'm including police, dispatching, and we happen to have inspections and environmental health in there also because they work closely hand in hand. Public safety and fire represent roughly 60% of our general fund budget. Public works is another basically 21%. So between those very fundamental services, you can see they're the bulk of what Richfield has to put on the street to provide those kinds of services. I did everything I possibly could to not have the cuts affect the people that we put on the street for fire protection, police protection, and even public works. For example, I've got a city accountant position vacant right now, my only city accountant, except there's a finance manager, and he's the only accountant left in the city. I'm not able to fill that accountant position, and I would rather have that open, even though it frightens the death out of me, it does, than to have to take an officer off the street. We will be laying off some other individuals and some other departments. There are some public works positions that we're holding open, and in public works supervisor positions that I expect to have open in the next month or so because of an early retirement. That won't be replaced. Also in administration, the administration executive departments have taken what's roughly 10 to 12% cuts in our budget to try and shield police and fire.
Thank you. Senator Moore?
Well, Mr. Chair, and, you know, to the two chiefs and the city manager and, you know, really all the individuals who've testified here, I sit on the tax committee, and so I have been listening to this conversation since 2003. I've sat on the tax conference committee that's come up with the tax bill every year that have added reduction after reduction after reduction to the local government aid. And in those capacities, I've had to listen to people from all different geographic areas in this state talk about the fact that it's Minneapolis-St. Paul who are always whining about our LGA, because I represent the city of St. Paul. And I'm sad to observe today that it isn't just Minneapolis and St. Paul, and specifically just St. Paul who's whining, but that it's an affliction that's affecting a lot of us. And I'm sad to see you here today, because it signifies that this has really is far deeper in its impact. And I think that I'm glad that Senator Higgins has agreed and decided to have this hearing in the Public Safety Committee, because it is a different venue to talk about the dramatic impact that the cuts in LGA has had on our state. And so perhaps this different lens and this different light on the local the cuts to local government aid might fall on more sympathetic ears. But I have to tell you that it's been very disheartening and rather lonely trying to push back time and again on the cuts to local government aid since 2003. And I feel like if we had been a little bit more successful earlier on, maybe we would have been able to stave off so much of what's happening today. So I want to thank you for being here. And I, for one, am have been miserable, and I'm glad to have your senator for company in that misery.
Senator Kielash, would you like to add anything to the comments here?
Well, I appreciate Senator Mao's testimony. I think what this is showing with all these shortcuts that the city is stating, and you've heard them all, so I don't need to repeat them, it's saying that we need some options for these cities to help get through this crisis. And I think levy limits are a huge part of the problem, and I think that we also have to look at some cities are better able to absorb these cuts than others, and we have to be mindful of that as we move forward. And public safety for Richfield, there's probably already been stated, but there's a large senior population that, and it's growing, and it demands a little more services. So cutting back on those EMT dollars and personnel, it just makes it that much more difficult to meet the growing needs of the city of Richfield. So.
Senator Higgins, thank you. Have a question? Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I've been trying to understand this, and I'm wanting to know if any of the cities, especially in the metropolitan area, have gone into a joint powers agreement. Do you get an economy of scale with teaming up with your neighbors on police functions?
Senator Limmer, members of the committee, thank you. First of all, we have a very extensive program working with other fire departments with mutual aid. We have a very extensive mutual aid. And we also, again, are working very carefully and closely with the Metro Police Gang Task Force. Our city, a long time ago, has tried to co-opt activities with other neighboring cities. For example, many years ago, we got rid of our assessing division, and we get that through Hennepin County. We got rid of one of the cuts in the 80s. Our internal inspections program, or for the most of it, and bought the services from City of Bloomington. And those are the things we've looked at, and those are the things we will look at. There are some, of course, some activities that we still need to have a base of in Richfield, but we're always looking for opportunities for joint powers agreements.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer,
there is a police department in the far western part of Hennepin County that all three cities have combined police forces, and it's one police force. So it only has one police chief, not three, but one. They're saving a great deal amount of money in the administration of that police department, and they seem to have a pretty good police force. And I'm wondering if towns, maybe not so much like Richfield, but perhaps the smaller areas, Crystal, New Hope, Robbinsdale, that are side-by-side cities regionally, and yet they have three separate administrations, three separate ways of doing things, three different holding jails, three different elements all in one. You've got little towns like the city of Osseo that I represent that will not team up with either Brooklyn Park or Maple Grove. And so there is issues here that I think causes us to maybe reinvent the entire system. I, too, sit on the tax committee. I hear the frustration on the part of what Senator Moi hears. But at the same time, I hear cities coming to us, and the very first thing in a crisis, they say they're going to cut the police force. And some of us have to scratch our head and say, in a large city budget, is there room to cut something else than just go straight to the police department? Because some of us, we get a little jaded a little bit, maybe perhaps a little cynical, and say, where's the priority of our funding if we're going to cut the police force? We always hear about that first. And is a police force that large of a budget portion of a city? Maybe you can help me understand that, because I see things in a city like park and rec departments, staffing. I go into some cities and they're just swarming with employees at many desks. I don't understand the function of a city, but some cities work in an entirely different way than other cities. So we all scratch our head trying to solve the problem. At the same time, we've got constituents out there who have seen for the last 3 or 4 years a declining value in their homes. Their assessed market value continues to go down 15, 20, 25, 30%, but their property taxes keep going up, and they are not going down, and that's hard to explain to the taxpayers when they call me. We have a lot of moving balls in the air when we're trying to help make sure that we have the requirements of government. Number one requirement is keeping our citizens safe.
Mr. Devich, would you care to comment on the proportion of the city's budget that goes toward police and fire?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, again, for the city of Richfield, 60% of our general fund budget is public safety and fire. The next 21% is public works. The next biggest department would be all the recreation programming, which is 9%. You can see that, again, you go back to the basic bread and butter services that the city of Richfield delivers, you're talking about public safety, fire, and public works. And again, you're talking about roughly 81% of our budget. And I will tell you that I tried extremely hard to touch other departments and take bigger hits out of other departments, even though they're far smaller, than to have to come and take hits out of police and fire. Believe me, we don't want to have to go to a five-person staffing and fire. We don't want to take officers off the street. And I think that what you're hearing here is that we're trying everything we can not to be in that position. But I will tell you that even despite our best efforts, if we're looking at the kinds of cuts that are being proposed for Richfield, you look at losing $1.8 million in 2010 out of a roughly $18 million budget, or 18.5. And again, look at the proportion of that public safety and fire have. It's going to be a real challenge not to do that, and that's, you know, that's what we're trying to preserve. We're trying to preserve the kinds of fundamental services that our citizens expect, and the kinds of services that keep a city like Richfield whole and competitive with other cities in the metro area that maybe aren't so dependent on local government aid and are newer.
Senator I want to thank our witnesses from Ridgefield for taking the time to be here. It's very helpful, and we appreciate that. Senator Higgins, did you have a question?
I just wanted to say that I believe we have four communities in Minnesota now that have decided to drop their police service. They've notified the sheriff's departments that they are no longer going to be having a police department at all. And the sheriffs have then told them how much is not going to be covered because the sheriffs are now, they have a county rather than the small town of, I want to say Virginia. Is that one of them? I remember.
Pretty big town.
One of those, yeah, wherever the Timber Jays publish.
Yeah.
Tower. Okay, thank you. Way up there somewhere.
Madam Chair, in the packets, the materials for today's meeting, there's a copy of an article in the Timber Jay newspaper covering Ely, Tower, and Cook.
There
talking about that. And it says they eliminated the police department. At least 30 communities now since 2003 have disbanded or consolidated with other regions. While Senator Ingebrigtsen makes his comment as well, I'd like to welcome, in addition to the agenda here, to the witness table, David Titus, President of the St. Paul Police Federation, and Jim Falkowski, Sergeant for the Gang Unit of the St. Paul Police Department. Please come forward, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, for those comments. Yes, this is nothing. This is certainly nothing new to rural sheriffs. We've been doing this for some time, and I think it's a combination of some of our smaller communities becoming smaller and not needing police departments. And I know that's probably not the issue here in the metro area, but nevertheless, this is nothing new. If the city has the opportunity to disband, they certainly can do that, I think. And I certainly appreciate the fact that they want their own police departments. I mean, I was 16 years a sheriff, approached by little communities in my county and contracted additional patrol, and the sheriff's patrol would actually take care of the town. So I would hate to see that come to this particular area, because public safety certainly is one of the things that we should be prioritizing for our tax dollar. It seems to me that in roads and every, you know, the infrastructure and whatnot. But unfortunately, the times right now are dictating some ingenuity here, and we're going to have to be dealing with some of this stuff. So, but I do hear the same thing that Senator Limmer was talking about is that the first thing we do talk about when budget cuts are is police and fire, and that actually happens when times weren't near as tough, and now they are tough. So I think everybody's going to be on the block for looking at cuts, but it's really unfortunate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You may hear the constituency screaming loudest from that, but you don't have a whole lot of park and rec employees that traipse over to the legislature to complain about cuts there. And they're also a tiny portion of the city's budgets. So it's inevitable, as you hear from the witnesses, that whether it's first or last on the priority list, it's inevitable that you're going to get to the public safety budgets at some point in with state aid cuts like this. Let's welcome David Titus and Sergeant Falkowski. Please,
committee members,
you have about 5 minutes each, if you wouldn't mind.
We will be brief.
Portion of the agenda to go to today.
Thank you. My name is Dave Titus. I am the president of the St. Paul Police Federation. We represent the labor, everybody in the St. Paul Police Department, including ECC, excluding the three chiefs. I'm joined here with Sergeant Jim Falkowski, who is a sergeant in our gang unit and also the vice president of the Federation. I certainly don't have the knowledge or the ability on how you get out of our current financial situation. But we have heard a lot of testimony by the chiefs and city administrators about the reductions in service. Also, some discussion about increased crime. We do believe that both of those are inevitable. Just so we know what we're working off of here, in St. Paul, our general fund is roughly 30% LGA. Our police department is roughly 35% of that general fund. Then you tack on fire, and you can see that is quickly consumed. What I would like to talk about is very simple, officer safety. We, in 2003, were at recent times low numbers in our city for patrol. There were a matter of weeks in our January and February months where we had three officers working our entire east side Now, if you divide our city into thirds, north and south, basically roughly take I-35E, go straight south to Mississippi, north and south, everything east of there is our east side, is our highest crime area. We had three officers working that on midnights because of our low numbers. We had approximately 1.8 officers per 1,000 in our city. We have since then gone on a campaign, the Federation has, and gotten commitments from our elected officials, local elected officials, to raise those numbers. And now we are at all-time highs. Right now, the instructions on our budget forecast for the next 2 years on cuts would put us through attrition a reduction of 50 to 60 officers. That would put us back to where we started. We'll be back to the point of where we have too few officers working the streets, and unfortunately, we will see crime eventually start to increase, especially in our neighborhoods like the East Side. Another thing that one of the chiefs from the chief from Columbia Heights spoke about was furloughs. Now, we all hear about furloughs, and we say that's a really nice thing. People are willing to take 8 hours off in their 40-hour work week, and that's how we're going to reduce. Well, very simply put, it's not a good thing. It's 20% of your workforce. Now, if we're going to lose through attrition 50 to 60 officers, and then if we were to agree to furloughs, that's a knock another 20% off, we simply would not have enough officers working our streets in St. Paul. It very simply would be an unsafe situation, and that's what I want to emphasize here enough. We were talking about parks and recs and libraries. Well, our work is life and death, and let's not forget that, because we don't want our officers in a situation where their backup is not right beside them. It is not instantly available, and that is what will happen if we do have to take the cuts that have been proposed at this point.
Sergeant Falkowski.
My name is Jim Falkowski. I'm a sergeant currently assigned in our gang unit. I'm also one of the sergeants on our SWAT team. Dave asked me to talk and touch a little bit on our specialty units within our department. Over the last several years, our specialty units have grown. Our gang unit was created, I believe, 5 years ago. It's, like Dave said, it's an officer safety issue. When somebody's purse is snatched, when somebody's robbed, when their car is stolen, they call 911. They don't want to hear on the other end of the phone, well, we don't have enough officers because we have them in specialty units doing gang investigations or narcotics investigations, whatever it is. They want a cop there, and they want them there now. We have, and I hate to use the word luxury, of having these specialty units. Luxury is a bad way to put it, but in the gang unit, the officers that I work with, we track all the gang members in St. Paul, and every day we add people to that list, the members that we're tracking. When a homicide happens, most of the homicides that happened in St. Paul last year were gang-related. When a homicide happens, we can't schedule the homicides to happen. They happen when they do, and a lot of the times they happen when we're not working and we get called in. If we don't have the officers who specialize in these fields and know who the gang member is, where that gang member's hanging out, what a specific gang nickname is. If we don't have that background, we're not going to catch those people. It's simple. The other specialized units within our police department, we have our force unit, which deals in problem property, specifically related to narcotics, the dope house down the street, the apartment that's selling drugs. If we cut our officers, we're going to have to fill those officers who are working in the squads. We're going to have to take them out of the force unit. And when the mom who's living in her apartment with her three kids keeps calling because they're dealing dope down the hall, she's going to basically get no response, no investigation. The response she's going to get is a uniformed cop is going to come out there. And that's not a good way to investigate that crime. A good way to investigate that crime is covertly, is through undercover detection, to go in and get those drug dealers out of there for good, not just a knock on the door. If you're a drug dealer, when the police knock on your door, you don't either answer the door or you don't let them in. We have ways covertly to get into these houses. You know, if these specialty units are cut, they're going to go away. crime's going to spiral. We also have our narcotics unit, which they deal in more mid-level drugs. The police chief from Winona talked about his problem being off of 94. Believe me, I know. I've been a police officer for 20 years, and I grew up in St. Paul. I know how drugs have changed the city that I grew up in. I know how this city has changed in 20 years. We have added members to our narcotics unit. They have been very successful. They did an outstanding job cleaning up downtown St. Paul last year. When our undercover narcotics operations go away because we need to put cops in the squads, we're going to lose all of the ground that we gained. We're going to lose all the ground that we gained. Our SWAT team, I don't think there's anything on our budget that isn't on the table for being cut. One of them is our SWAT team. Back in, I believe it was December or early January, Roseville's SWAT team, they have a joint SWAT team with Roseville and some of the surrounding communities out there, they had an officer-involved shooting. It was a situation where they couldn't handle it, and they called our SWAT team because of the training and professionalism that our SWAT team, we have a very good reputation around the state. We went there to assist them. When cops are calling for help, you know it's a bad day. If all these cuts happen, people are going to get hurt. People that I care about are going to get hurt. The citizens, crime is going to go up. There is no doubt. And I don't want to whine like somebody else said. I'm just stating the facts. I know you have a tough job, but those are the facts. Thank you for listening.
I want to thank both of you for coming here today. Any questions, Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chairman, and either of the officers, one of the things that's not in this budget area but is in the governor's budget is eliminating many people from the General Assistance Medical Care Program. A majority of those people suffer from mental illness, and I'm wondering how much of your time is spent responding to those type of calls within the city of St. Paul.
Well, I think it's fair to say that we couldn't tell you exactly, but a person who works in the downtown beat is dealing with the mentally ill constantly. I worked downtown for 6 years, and a vast majority of your homeless, to some degree, have a mental illness. So it depends on where you work, but clearly it's a large portion.
So if these people no longer have medical care available to them, you would anticipate a great increase in the number of calls you would be getting?
I think you're going to see an increase in many categories, and that would be one of them.
Thank you.
Any other questions? We're going to wrap this portion of the agenda up. Thank you both for coming and sharing the information
with
us.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to turn the chair back to Senator Higgins.
You know, it's interesting. I was late to this meeting because I was over in the Economic Development Budget Division having a presentation on our summer jobs program for youth in Minneapolis. And it was real clear that the members over there understood that if the youth of our city don't have anything to do with the jobs, the gentlemen in blue here are going to be seeing them more often than they would want to as well. So it's kind of a interwoven collection of things that we work on. We're right across the hall at the same time this term. So the next item that we wanted to talk about today is the short-term offender program that we have, where people who are sentenced to less than a year are sent to our local jails rather than to DOC. We thought we would start with Chris Turner, our Senate fiscal analyst, to give us a history of the program. And then we have Mr. Mers from DOC and Commissioner Jeff Johnson and Janine Rosas from Hennepin County to talk as well. And I don't know if there are other people in the room who'd want to weigh in on this as well. So I think we'll start with Mr. Turner. Members, you've got a whole collection of things in your packets related to short-term offenders. Mr. Turner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to be going over the fact sheet that's been distributed on short-term offenders. It's a distillation of the issue. If you'd like a more in-depth look, I suggest you check the DOC's website. And on it is the 2007 short-term offender report. It's under the legislative reports, and it includes the minutes and recommendations of the short-term offender work group. Your packet also includes a brief legislative history of the issue. There's a simple reason why the short-term offender is a contentious issue. The legislation that passed in 2003 shifted millions of dollars of correctional costs from the state to the counties, with the understanding that the state would at least partially subsidize the counties on a prorated basis for the use of their facilities. The state subsidies haven't even come close to covering the cost of the counties, and that's basically why we're here today. I'd like to start with the definition of who is a short-term offender. One of the problems I've had working this issue for 15 years has been keeping the definition straight in my mind. The 2003 legislature modified Minnesota law to provide that defendants with a felony sentence of imprisonment where the remaining term of imprisonment is for 180 days or less would be committed to the Commissioner of Corrections but serve the remaining term of imprisonment at a workhouse or a county jail. This means that the short-term offender population can only be comprised of two categories of offenders: those convicted of relatively low-level felonies who are committed to the commissioner but have less than 180 days left to serve, and a subset of probation violators. It does not apply to offenders who violate the conditions of their supervised release from prison, some of whom, roughly 100 a day on any given day, are housed at the county level. It should also be noted that sex offenders of any kind cannot be short-term offenders and must serve their entire prison term. So who are our short-term offenders? The 2007 DOC report to the legislature gives the two concrete examples of the application of the law. The first would be a new felony offender. In this scenario, the offender would be convicted and sentenced to the commissioner for a year and a day. By law, the offender would serve two-thirds of the sentence incarcerated and a third on supervised release. For a year and a day sentence, the offender would then serve 8 months with good time. During the court process, the offender spends 3 months in jail pretrial, reducing the remaining time to serve from 8 months to 5 months. Therefore, the offender would qualify as a short-term offender. The second type would be the probation violator. To have an offender is convicted of a felony and sentenced to a year and a day, the imposition is stayed, in this example, on condition of 100 days in jail and a probation of 5 years. The offender would serve his jail time and be placed on probation. While on probation, the offender would be convicted of, in this case, a gross misdemeanor and spend 90 days in jail. This new offense is a violation of probation, so the court would revoke the stay of imposition on the felony offense and sentence the offender to a year and a day in prison. Except in this case, he would get credit for time served, which at this point would be 190 days, and that would leave only 176 days left to be served. Therefore, he would qualify as a short-term offender. 90% of Minnesota short-term offenders are probation violators, the second type. 10% become short-term offenders because of a relatively low-level felony offense in the circumstances of the court procedure, i.e., pretrial jail credit. I'm going to go into the number of offenders and state funding. The short-term offender law places the cost of housing a felon committed to the Commissioner of Corrections on the counties. To offset this cost, the legislature has appropriated money each year since fiscal year 2004 to be distributed to the counties at the end of each fiscal year on a prorated basis. 20% of this appropriation is set aside for inpatient medical costs. Outpatient costs are the responsibility of the counties. Any unused portion of the medical reimbursement gets added back into the money available for the per diem reimbursement at the end of the year. To date, the 20% medical set aside has yet to be exhausted in any given year. There's a table in your fact sheet that shows the history of legislative funding since the law went into effect. You can see in 2003 the law was passed, went into effect for fiscal year 2004. The number of short-term offenders at that time was 242. The funding was set at $1,207,000. That came out to a per diem of roughly $14 per day. The average per diem for a county jail is between $55 and $60, so you can see the disparity. As you go down, the number of short-term offenders increases every year, 297 in 2005, same annual funding of $1.2 million. The per diem at the end of the year for the counties came down to roughly $11 per day. Next year, 2006, 319 to $1.2 million. Per diem fell to $10 per day. 2007, 356 short-term offenders, $1.2 million in funding, and it fell to $9 per day. At this point, the legislature was, it had heard enough about the inadequacy of the per diem and was very sympathetic to that argument. So in 2008, the legislature included an additional $2.5 million per year to bring up the annual funding to $3,707,000. Once again, there's another jump in the number of offenders, in this short jump from 356 to 360. But with the additional money of $3.7 million a year, the per diem reimbursement came to $29 per day. Now, last year, as part of the budget cuts, the legislature cut that annual funding to $1.6 million, not as low as 1.2 as it had been, but certainly quite a cut. Based on the 360 offenders from 2008, we estimate that the per diem has fallen back to estimated at $12 per day. So we're pretty much back where we started. As I mentioned, the average cost of housing an inmate in a county jail is between $55 and $60 per day. If the legislature completely funded the local impact at an average per diem of $55, using the 2008 average of 360 beds, the estimated cost of the state would be $7.2 million per year. That would mean $5.6 million in new money, because the current appropriation is $1.6 million. To make the counties whole for the entire 2010 and 2011 biennium would cost the state $11.2 million. That, Madam Chair and members, is where we stand after about 15 years of wrestling with this issue. Real quickly, the legislative history on the short-term offender, although it was an issue before 1993, the legislative history starts in 93 when the DOC proposed that all offenders with one year or less at this time remain the responsibility of the county where the offender was committed. The legislature didn't accept this proposal and instead required the DOC to report on the issue the following year. The 1994 DOC report did not support the issue of short-term offenders being housed at the counties. Instead, it recommended that the state expand the challenge incarceration program and look into establishing state-operated facilities, independent state-operated facilities for short-term offenders. The legislative history has a gap there until 2001, when the legislature again directed the DOC to report on alternatives for dealing with short-term offenders who serve less than 1 year in prison. Again, we were still speaking about 1 year at that time. In 2003, the DOC, in the governor's budget, recommended that short-term offenders serving less than 6 months be housed in county jails rather than DOC facilities, thus shifting the financial responsibility to the counties. This proposal was made at a time when the state faced a very large budget deficit, and everyone was searching for ways to reduce state spending. On any given day, the DOC estimated this population represented 200 of its inmates. The projected savings to the state was estimated at $8 million for the biennium. The governor's proposal did not include any funding to help offset the cost of the counties. But the legislature, which adopted the governor's proposal, included an appropriation of $1.2 million per year to help with the cost of the counties. It was an appropriation that was to be distributed on a prorated basis and included the 20% medical offset. and it amounted to approximately, as we saw earlier, $14 per day per inmate for fiscal year 2004. 2007, the governor recommended an increase of $2.19 million each year in reimbursement to the counties. The legislature increased the governor's recommendation and passed an appropriation of $2.5 million each year for a total of $3.7 million annually. That change brought the per diem up to approximately $9 per day. Then in 2008, to help address the budget deficit, funding for short-term offenders was reduced by $2.1 million each year, beginning in fiscal year 2009. This now results in an overall appropriation of $1.6 million. The per diem reimbursement rate, as we've seen earlier, is estimated to be approximately, or will be, about $12 for the counties based on 360 offenders. And that, Madam Chair, is where we stand today.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, Mr. Turner, I have always been a little bit confused about the 20% of the appropriation that's set aside for inpatient medical costs. Does that get who holds on to that money? And then does that money carry over from budget cycle to budget cycle, or how does that work?
And does the budget does the medical cost include treatment, Mr. Turner?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, the money, the 20%, if it is not spent at the end of the year, it returns to the overall pot of money that is distributed on a prorated basis.
I see.
The state has never reached, I don't think it's even come close to the 20%. And these are, if Mr. Mers can correct me if I'm wrong, these are inpatient costs only. I do not believe it includes treatment, and outpatient costs are borne by the county. I hope I'm correct on that, and Mr. Mers can tell me if I am.
Okay. Any questions before Mr. Mers? Mr. Mers, thank you,
Madam Chair and members. My name's Ken Mers. I'm a director with the Community Services Division with the Department of Corrections. And since the implementation of the short-term offender legislation, myself and Mr. Colin Gao, who is an associate warden at our St. Cloud facility, were given the responsibility to try and make this program work. In an effort to do that, we put together a work group consisting of county sheriffs, jail administrators, local corrections officials, as well as some county commissioners. And we sat down and we started looking at this. Everyone realized from day one that the appropriation was not going to be sufficient to offset all of the costs that were going to have to be borne by the counties. And so what we attempted to do, Mr. Turner certainly gave you a good history of the funding and on the legislative reports. So what we attempted to do was to look at what may be some of the major expenses to the counties. The counties were extremely concerned about any possible added medical costs that this population might incur. And so the work group decided that we would take 20% of the appropriation, set it aside, and that the Department of Corrections would use that for any major inpatient medical costs. If those medical costs ever exceeded the 20%, that would have to then, whatever that over that 20% would have to be borne by the Department of Corrections. It would not be borne by the counties. If we did not use the full 20%, as Mr. Turner said, then that money would be put back into the pot for the housing and added to it so that it would increase the per diem, whatever amount that might be. Another thing that we attempted to do was, knowing that the sex offender would create another hardship on the counties based on the fact that there is a lot of additional paperwork, a lot of additional work that needs to be done with them as far as doing an end of confinement review committee, having them assigned a risk level, it was determined that all sex offenders would come to prison. There would not be a short-term offender who is a sex offender. Another thing then we attempted to do was to The commissioner gave her authority to the local sheriff to be the main decider for all programming issues. With that, it was determined that if the sheriff felt it was appropriate, he could take the short-term offender, he could put him on electronic monitoring, he could put him on work release, he could put him on an STS crew, he could do any of those type of alternatives rather than having the individual into jail all the time. So that was another thing that we attempted to do. Another thing that we agreed to do would be that if any short-term offender created an undue hardship on a county, if they were extremely assaultive, if they were destructive, if they were destroying property, or if they were just an exceptional medical case where it was their medications that were creating a problem for the facility, then on a case-by-case basis, they would get a hold of myself or Mr. Gao. We would look at the case on an individual basis, and then if appropriate, we would then bring that offender into our system rather than have them stay in the county. So that's just a little bit of the history of how we tried to set the program up, and our work group continued to meet over the first 3 years, probably 4 years of the short-term offender program. When a new situation would come up, we would get together, we would discuss it, and we would put into policy how we would handle these situations. Obviously, the short-term offender program has had some unintended consequences. And I think if you'll look at the paper that we handed out to you, you'll see that in the 5 years prior to the implementation of the STO law from 1999 to 2003, the annual number of admissions to a state prison was somewhere around 638. Of that 638 admissions, then that translated into approximately 200 on any given day that were serving less than 180 days within one of our facilities. In the 5 years since enactment of the STO law, from 2004 to 2008, the average number of admissions has gone up to almost doubled to 1,270. And, of course, then that also then would translate into the number of STOs being in that 360 to 370 range on any given day. If you turn this over, you'll notice a chart that talks about jail credit. And again, in the 5 years prior to enactment of the STO law, the average number of jail credit days for offenders serving the less than 180 days was 155 days. During the 5 years since the implementation, the average number of jail credit days was up to 204. So what we have seen is that there are a number of cases where with agreement between the defense attorneys, the county attorneys, and the judges, that individuals are delaying having their cases come to court in order for a plea bargain to have their sentences executed so that they would fall into that 180-day short-term offender category and they'd be able to serve their time at a local level. At the very bottom, you'll also see that one of the reasons that many offenders are doing this is because what they end up doing is actually serving less time on supervision in the community, because when they execute their sentence, they may have an additional 2 or 3 years of probation hanging over their head, but when they execute their sentence, they'll go technically be going to prison, coming out on supervised release, and that supervised release time in the community will be much less than what they would have done under probation. So they're basically getting out from under their supervision earlier by taking advantage of this program. So where we are today is the commissioner certainly understands that this is a problem with the counties. She is in conversations with the Sheriff's Association. We've had discussions with Dodge Fillmore Olmsted, who has given us a proposal to look at, which we have done. I have to say that in principle, It makes sense. However, there are some practicalities that that are still needed to be worked out. That's all I have, Madam Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Mears. But during your discussions over the years, the question I have is, I know that some counties have pay to stay, where the prisoner actually pays X amount of dollars to stay in the facility. Has that ever been talked about with the short-term offender? I don't remember that, working in the middle of it when it first came out. But if they were there to be under the guidance of the sheriff or the jail administrator, in most cases, to be able to go out on work release, was there ever discussion of pay to stay?
Mr. Mercer.
Madam Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes, in fact, that is a part of our policy. And again, the work group, when that came into effect, when the pay-to-stay law came into effect, we met with our group, and we also then said that if a short-term offender was sentenced to a county jail, the sheriff could charge that short-term offender for that stay.
Mr. Mercer, do you know how many actually are paying that?
We do not collect that, Madam Chair. That would be on an individual county-by-county basis. Quite frankly, this is one of the things that has baffled me, because obviously the word got out that if you got more jail credit and you fell under the 180 days, you could serve that time locally. You may get less supervision time. So that word spread very quickly. Why the pay for stay hasn't spread as quickly to the offenders, I don't know, but it hasn't seemed to have any effect so far.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In this discussion, I noticed that Mr. Turner's report, and I don't know if you can add to this, but under the number of short-term offenders that counties hold, is the practice still in, or is it still the practice when there's a short-term remaining sentence of someone in our prisons? I know that sometimes they get transferred to the local, let's say, county workhouse if there's less than a year, or sometimes a little over a year. Is that still a practice that's conducted? And then is it reflected in the number of STOs on this report? And then who would pay for that? I would think that it's the state, that budget continues to follow the individual, and then there would be a reimbursement to the counties for that bed being used in a county facility. So is that reflected in this report?
Mr. Turner?
I'm sorry, Senator Limmer. Could you rephrase that? Who are you talking about?
Okay, under the STOs in the mm-hmm. years that are accumulating here, have you recognized the difference? I know that it used to be the practice that if the state needed room in a prison, they would take some prisoners that might have a year or a little over a year left, and they would move them locally back to the county correction facility. And the budget, I think, follows from the state. The state would reimburse the county for that time that that person is tying up a cell. And so I just wanted to know if that has been included in your number of STOs or not, or is that a practice that just doesn't work anymore? I don't know.
Mr. Turner?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, the state does contract with counties, and they do pay a per diem, a full per diem, when they contract for prisoners, the ones that I think you're describing. Plus, the state contracts with counties for supervised releasees. On any given day, there's about 100 of them, I think, out in at the county level, and they reimburse, I think, $56 a day for that. Mm-hmm. Is that correct, Mr. Mears?
Mr. Mears.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, the short-term offender is only on the front end. At the time of sentencing, if they have 180 days or less to serve, that's when they must serve that time on the local level. As Mr. Turner said, we do contract with local county jails for some offenders. It's not anyone, it's not, as you said, where they're within their last year and so on, as a step out of the institutions. Based on our capacity issues and so forth, we do contract with county jails to hold some of our offenders. We do have a work release program where we have contracts with local county jails to hold our work release offenders. They would be the only ones that would actually be working their way back into the community is through our work release program. And we also have a contract with the Appleton facility to hold some of our offenders based on population pressures.
Okay. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I just want to remind us the reason that we focused on the short-term offenders was because of the inefficiency of bringing them into the state system. It really takes 6 months to process somebody to come in, to do the assessments as to their health and their mental health and their medical needs and where they should be placed once they end up in the prison system. And so if you just finish that work and then their sentence is over, it's sort of an inefficient use of money to do all of that. And so that's why the focus was on short-term offenders staying at the local level.
Madam Chair, and absolutely right, Senator Berglund. And to go along with that, even though the law says it's 180 days or less and you're talking 6 months, I believe the average stay of all of our short-term offenders is more like 3.5 to 4 months by the time they get their jail credit and so forth. And we have many cases where they are actually coming to us when their time has all been served, basically, and they really don't have any time left on their sentences.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Mers. Commissioner Johnson. This is your first trip here as a new commissioner.
Actually, I came and took the tour with my Cub Scout group on Saturday, so it's my second trip back.
Go ahead and identify yourself for the tape, please.
Jeff Johnson, I'm a Hennepin County Commissioner.
Jerry Dreesen, Hennepin County Department of Corrections.
Janine Rosas, Hennepin County Department of Corrections. Thank you all for coming. I understand you're representing many of the counties and
yes.
the coalition that tries to work through this mess. I'm sorry.
Yes. yes.
Puzzle. Let's call it.
That is correct. Thank you for having us today. As I mentioned, I'm a new member of the Hennepin County Board, and I'm representing the association. We are representing the Association of Minnesota Counties as well as the Hennepin County Board to talk about this short-term offender issue. And ideally, for counties, we would ask that you actually eliminate the program. Most of you, maybe other than Senator Ingebrigtsen, were here in 2003 with me, and some of us, including me, voted to actually create this program. I remember when the issue came up, I had some concerns about it because it seemed to me to be essentially just a blatant transfer of costs from the state to the county, but I supported it as part of the package. And because I don't always see transfers from the state to the county as a bad thing. There are certain situations where counties are more appropriate places for services to be given or more appropriate areas for people to go to than the state. But I think what we've learned in the last few years, especially as the number of short-term offenders has grown, is this is exactly the opposite. And I think we have found that counties do not provide the services necessary, especially on reentry, to these short-term offenders as the state can do and as the state system can do. And because of that, I think that this is not just a transfer of cost and a very onerous one, but also bad public policy. Let me just mention the cost first. And what I have are numbers from Hennepin County, but you could extrapolate this to other counties depending on their size. One of our handouts is this. I think you have it in color, but there's four bars up on the top there and three on the side. And that simply goes through a study that was done
at our adult corrections facility, which is the Plymouth Workhouse. It's the county jail. That's in my district. And for a four-year period, we measured, or the county measured, the short-term offenders who were housed at and released from the ACF, or the workhouse, and what sort of recidivism rates we saw. And for that four-year period, or for a three-year period, what we saw, as you go down to the middle there with the bullet points, short-term offenders were convicted of new offenses at the following rates. Bottom line, in 3 years, it was a 74% recidivism rate. And the paragraph below that shows that 60% of those were felonies, and even below there, several of them were actually violent felonies. And that 74% recidivism rate compares rather unfavorably with the 50% rate that we see for other non-STO felon offenders, which 50% is a pretty miserable number for recidivism, but it's a lot better than 74%. It's also considerably higher than the recidivism rate for Minnesota Department of Correction offenders just in general. And so the question then arises, why are the numbers for STOs, at least in Hennepin County, so high? And there really may be a lot of reasons, but the one that's most logical to me and to the AMC is also the reason that makes this such bad public policy. Counties do not handle reentry of felons at this level nearly as well as the state does. The Minnesota DOC does a pretty good job of providing reentry services to felons that are reentering our communities. Counties don't. This is just generally not our population in our prisons, and they are not getting the same services that they would get if they were in the state prison system. And right now we're seeing the DOC and the legislature making really some good progress on some of these reentry issues. But while this is happening, a lot of the short-term offenders are getting little or nothing from counties because that's essentially a different population than what counties are used to serving. And I think because of that, we're seeing the STOs recommit at a much higher rate than we would see if they were staying in the state system and going to state prison instead of to county jails. And, of course, that is not just then onerous to the county taxpayers, but it's onerous to the state taxpayers because they are reoffending at higher rates than they otherwise would be and going right back into the system. So with that, Madam Chair, I will stop, and I think maybe Ms. Rosas had some comments, or I'll answer questions. Try to.
Questions at this point? Ms. Rosas, thank you for coming.
Yes, I just emphasize the reentry issue, that the county is not set up to provide reentry services for these kinds of offenders. As you see from our handout, these are people with a lot of deficits. They're pretty young. They're poorly educated. They're unmarried, so they don't have that traditional spousal support. I also know that a lot of them have children. Some of them have child support they're not paying. Some of them have not seen their children in many years. They're heavily minority individuals, and they're heavily males. These are people with lots of deficits. They're also heavily chemically dependent, either on alcohol or drugs. The other thing they're missing out from by not being in state prison is the in-prison chemical dependency treatment that the prison system offers for at least the highest third, the highest risk third of their offenders.
That's true.
Madam Chair, I would add.
Mr. Dreesen.
I would add also that one of the things that makes this population different from the population that we normally see at the workhouse is how the Minnesota sentencing guidelines structure is set up. These are folks who have committed and been convicted of many times 6 to 7 felonies before the commit to Commissioner of Corrections even occurs. And so if you look at that and you look at these recidivism rates, it's not really that surprising. The difference is, again, going back to the reentry issue, if you don't have that critical handoff back to a parole agent, a supervised release agent, where they're getting more intense supervision, and that them coming out of state prison, there's a case plan, there's a, you know, where are you going to live, are you going to get a job, all that stuff is put in place, and you're putting this on an offender population that's already committed and been convicted of 6 to 7 felonies before they even qualify as an STO, you have a pretty good chance that you're going to see these recidivism rates.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know this report from Hennepin County is a snapshot in time, and I know Commissioner Johnson is 45 days into his new job, and so
Is this an ongoing pattern of recidivism rate, or is this something that's spiking at this time? Is there a history that anyone knows on the table there?
Do you know? I don't know.
This is a, you're correct. This is a snapshot that we actually did a full analysis of all offenders in the Hennepin County's workhouse for the 2003 cohort and followed them up. And as you know, this law just went into place in 2003, and we saw that the STOs had a much higher recidivism rate, but the problem was we only had like 20 or 30 of them in 2003. So then I asked our researchers to take a look at all the STOs and followed them throughout time. I don't know the answer to your question, but I'm not surprised by these rates given what we know about who these STOs are and how many crimes they commit before going to are being committed to the commissioner. So I do not expect that it's a spike. I expect that this is probably what you would see if STO program continues.
And Chair, about 25 years ago, I worked at the county workhouse. I was employed by the county, that is. but as a correction officer, having just recently had a degree in criminology, I kept asking and doing a kind of my own informal poll of the residents that were there, and one thing on the demographics that's missing, and I don't know if it's the same, I would venture to guess that it probably is the same, about 95% of the residents come from either broken or abusive homes. And that is a very dominant pattern that was very easily determined, and it goes deeper than the present snapshot that is reflected here. This problem starts really, really early with criminal population. And I'm surprised that the recidivism on 1, 2, or 3 year patterns are as high as they are. This is exceptionally high, but this is a little different. Most of the offenders are younger also. An older offender would probably a more seasoned, more experienced criminal would be more involved in felony crimes, and if they have a past history, they're going to a facility far away from the county. So it's a little different view of the demographics, but still a burden on the taxpayer by having that high of a recidivism rate.
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, I was struck when Mr. Merce was up when he said, I think he said 90% of the people who fall into the short-term offender category, 90% of them are what do you call it, parole violators or probation violators. Is that right? And
He's shaking his head.
Nodding his head. Yes. So are you finding that to be the case in Hennepin County?
Madam Chair, Senator Ma, yes, we are. These are people who have a sentence, felony sentence imposed, but then it's stayed, often on the condition of doing some jail time, which is in Hennepin County, served in the workhouse. Then they're put on probation.
Mm-hmm.
If they violate, then they come back and the court imposes the sentence at some point, and then they become a short-term offender. So they're usually the sentence is imposed but stayed.
Madam Chair, and of these probation violators, how many of them would you say or do you track would be part of a reentry program out in the community?
Ms. Rosas? I do know that the Network for Better Futures is a nonprofit that has taken some of our short-term offenders, has taken 17 of them in the last year out of approximately 200 that we discharged in the last year. So a small percentage were going to the network. Other than that, there are a few other reentry type services. St. Stephen's helps people with housing. A lot of these people also are homeless when they come to the ACF, and of course then are homeless when they leave the ACF. So just another aspect of the deficits that they pose to us in Hennepin County.
Madam Chair, just can I add one thing to Senator Mao's question? I think if you're going where I think you're going, The answer to your question is actually none of them would have been in a reentry program because they're on probation. Reentry by definition, is set up for those on supervised release, which is known commonly as parole, coming out of prison. So these folks, they haven't been exposed to reentry services. They're younger. They're climbing their way up to meet sentencing guidelines and get more prison time and get into the reentry programs if they continue their criminality that you might be talking about. So what Janine is referencing is once they get to the workhouse, a select number of them do get into the network or some reentry stuff, but most of the people haven't gotten there yet. So they're on probation and then they get violated. The judge then typically gives them a couple more breaks. They say go to the workhouse for 30 days before they revoke them, commit to the commit to the commissioner and execute their sentence. So you're seeing lots and lots of breaks go on over fairly significant criminal involvement over their lives.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You talked a little bit earlier about pay to stay. Does Hennepin County participate in that pay to stay program or not? I know there were some questions I know when it first came out whether it was going to be worth the people power to have to collect from those folks. But where I come from, we did that and it was very successful. In fact, I think we had I wasn't near 100% clearance rate, but it was like at least 75-80% collection rate, and they had ownership of that. It's something invested there, and it was a great, great program. I'm just wondering if Hennepin County participates in that.
Mr. Dreesen?
For our STO population, I believe the answer is no.
Was that a conscious decision to not do that?
One of the things that I think many people don't put this together about Hennepin County and two or three other counties in the state is there are two different types of jails in Hennepin County, one run by the sheriff and one run by corrections. Pretrial jail services are run by the sheriff, and then post-adjudication, post-disposition is run by the Department of Community Corrections. My understanding, I've got it on my to-do list to look into, is most of that pay-for-stay was designed for to relieve pretrial jail costs. Now, I'll look into it, but I wasn't until today aware that could also apply for post adjudication. So I will be looking into it.
And Senator, one of the reasons it's on his to-do list is because I just said to him, why aren't we doing that? So he said, I can't do it, because we should be if we can.
Yeah, excuse me, just a follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a tremendous program. The public really likes that, and they're paying back something and not just a burden, you know, and they're able to keep their jobs and they're able to keep working. So it's a great program.
Mr. Tuma, do you want to add to the conversation?
Madam Chair, I apologize. Whispering his ear. John Tuma. I'm here on behalf of MICA. One of the things that we heard particularly was done by Washington County, took a snapshot of who these short-term offenders are. And I know corrections gets up here and says, you know, the guys that are in prison belong in prison in Minnesota. The same guys that are putting those guys in prison are your judges, are the same guys turning these guys into short-term offenders. And there's a reason for it. When he took the snapshot of it, he was surprised to find out the rap sheets on some of these guys. They're not your guy who's in there for a DWI that needs to be on work release. These are the real bad apples. The reason they ended up short-term offender is because a judge tried to give them a chance. And then what happens is they go back not once for a technical violation. They go back time and time again. On average, it was 7 revisits in front of the judge before he finally got fed up, okay, and said, I'm executing your sentence. And that's why they end up short-term offenders. It's not because, oh, these are guys that are petty thieves. These are serious offenders. They're doing serious crimes. And so when Tom Atkins did his snapshot of his 15 offenders, on average, they were back in front of the judge 7 times. They were doing serious violations before the judge finally got fed up and said, I'm executing your sentence. And on some occasions, they even reserved additional jail time while the judge restructured their probation. So when we look at it and say, oh, let's just put him on work release. Oh, let's just do this. Remember, the judge is making a conscious decision. This guy is a real bad actor. I want him in prison. Unfortunately, he only has less than 6 months to serve, so he ends up serving time in our local jail. So don't view these guys as a DWI guy who needs a second chance or a job. Okay, these are guys who have been seriously doing things that have annoyed a judge to the point where he says, time for you to go to prison. And I can get you that breakdown of those 15 offenders, Madam Chair, so that you can see at least what Tom Atkins was finding out when he actually took a snapshot of the short-term offenders that are sitting in his facility.
Thank you. If you get that to us, we'll make sure everybody on the committee gets that. And if people want more information on the pay to stay, I think Mr. Burns has some information on statistics.
Yes, Madam Chair, just a point of clarification. By statute, you cannot charge, the sheriff cannot charge a pretrial offender pay for stay. The person has to be serving a sentence right in the local facility in order to charge him. And then I also just wanted to mention very quickly that the Hennepin County, they're absolutely right. This is a very tough population, especially as far as trying to do any type of reentry planning with, simply because they have such a short period of time. As Senator Berglund mentioned earlier, by the time they come into prison, they go through any type of assessments, they do any of the intake requirements, there is no time really to do any adequate reentry planning with them in the institutions. That's the major problem with this population, is that short period of time. In an effort to try and alleviate some of that problem, we have developed what we call our HOF unit, and that's housed out of facility, which is a group of caseworkers that work specifically with this short-term offender population. They do the release planning for all short-term offenders. They work with the local corrections agent in developing that release plan, as well as working with we have a series of a short-term offender contact at every county jail in the state that we also work with when we do that. It's not the greatest release plan. It's not the best case plan. But given the short period of time we have with these individuals, it's the best that we can do at this point.
And does that HOC group work in all the counties? Or
The HOF unit, the caseworkers, are housed at Faribault, and they work primarily by telephone, by fax, by email, with the agents in the local areas where the offender is being housed, as well as that short-term contact at the county jail.
Senator Moore?
Well, Mr. Mers, how many bodies do you have as part of your HOF unit?
We have 3 caseworkers that deal with the short-term offender population.
And so, Madam Chair, and Mr. Mers, in any given week, how many people do they work with?
Mr. Mers.
No. Anywhere from 1 to 100. It's very similar to the caseload of a caseworker within the institution that has their own caseload within each of the institutions also.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not going to ask Mr. Mers this, but I can't imagine that a person could get real detailed in terms of into the work. It not the staff people aren't at fault, but 3 bodies to serve this many cases. I mean, how detailed can you get into the
part of the problem,
the work plans?
Well, you know, even just looking at the Hennepin County flyer that was here, I mean, there were 21,000 bed days, the average of 59 people a day, if I'm reading it correctly, that were considered short-term offenders in Hennepin County. So it's not a small population, right? Any other questions? Is there anybody else in the room who would like to add anything to this discussion?
Madam Chair, can I just add one thing?
Commissioner.
We were talking before we got up here, and I just want to point out that unlike most groups that will come before you today,
or this year, we're not here asking for anything from the state. We actually want to give something back to the state.
Love it.
What do we do now?
Thanks.
Thank you all. Members, our next hearing is on Wednesday, and we'll be talking about... I've forgotten. Oh, that's right. Pass-through funding that is recommended to be decreased, and then the Corrections Department Retirement Fund, what do they call that thing, SERP? And we'll be hearing from some folks who would potentially be affected by that.
Madam Chair, that's in terms of pass-through from the feds?
Pass-through from us to the locals.
Oh.
The government recommending.
Governor's recommending. The governor's recommending a cut in those. We are, Senator Limmer, and then...
Do we have any, speaking of that, do we have any federal money that we can, that gets passed to us?
There is, in the stimulus bill, about $3 billion in public safety, mostly like burn grants, the burn JAG grants. I guess they're really not called burn grants anymore. They're called JAG grants. But how much of that will come to us, I don't know. Last year we got only $2 million in those grants, and so an increase would be really nice. We could put it to good use. We are adjourned. Thank you all.